Hey everybody, this is Stu Smith with another Two Through and After series, and we have a special guest, Jason Sweet. Welcome.
Thanks for having me on, Stu.
Absolutely. So, yeah, Jason Sweet was an Air Force pararescueman back in the day, but we're going to talk about his journey from young Jason all the way to what he's doing now with his SOCOM athlete business. And everything in between. So this is all about you, Jason.
Right on, Stu. Sounds good, my man.
All right, so let's get it started. So who was Jason Sweet as a kid?
Oh, man. The first thing that comes to mind is troublemaker, Stu. My dad was a PJ, and he was stationed at the 1730th Pararescue Squadron is what it was called, and that's now been moved over to Herbert Field and is now the 23rd STS. So I was born right down here in the Eglin Air Force Base area. Got to grow up doing some snorkeling and just being around the community a little bit. And then dad actually ended up getting out when I was about 2 or 3 years old. Mm. So that was my childhood, was being here in the panhandle of Florida and just getting into sports. My dad got me into karate at a young age, helped me burn off some of that energy that I had, played a little football, sucked at it. When I was young, by the way, still kind of suck at it, but got into baseball as well.
Okay. All right. So let's talk a little bit about that. North Florida. I grew up in North Florida as well, just on the other side of Tallahassee. So I know the area very well. How about your high school life? You know, what was it that drove you in high school to work hard?
Yeah, man, this was a big change in my life that happened. My dad moved us from Florida to Arizona. And so we came from being in somewhat of a rural area in Florida to being in a little mountain town called Payson, Arizona. Now, it was a pretty big culture shock for me. But one thing I loved about Payson is everyone there was very real and very open. There wasn't a lot of judgmental people there. And I felt that I could be myself. So I enjoyed growing up in a small town, developing those relationships. And for the first time, I actually had an opportunity to start excelling in sports. And obviously as a young man, when you hit your teen years, you start going through changes and maturing physically and developing physically. You'll have muscles in places where you never thought before. So it was really cool to start developing as an athlete after moving to Arizona.
Yeah. So tell me this, you know, you probably started lifting weights or maybe mixed in some calisthenics. What was it that you started seeing results in pretty quickly? And how old were you when you started lifting?
My dad forced me to go to Gold's Gym with him right down on Highway 98 east of Destin at 5:30 in the morning, every morning when I was 6 years old. And I did not enjoy it, Stu. He got me this, I want it kind of like a personal trainer. He was more of like a mentor and his name was Paul. And Paul would always tell me to lower the weight and work on having better form. And it used to make me so mad because all I wanted to do was lift heavy weight. And all Paul wanted me to do was focus on form.
So you know, that's a good coach.
It was a great coach. And it was really what had established my base as focusing on form instead of just throwing around heavy stuff all the time.
I like that. So what were the sports that you were pretty good at?
Right. So I played football in high school. I only played my freshman, sophomore and senior year because I was a better baseball player. I enjoyed football more, but I wanted to focus on trying to get a baseball scholarship and getting out of that small town. So I sacrificed basketball whenever I got into high school and just narrowed it down to being a two-sport athlete. Being in a small town, it's difficult to get scouted. So I would play in these travel baseball leagues down in Phoenix, and we would travel to San Diego. There were scout clubs. So I ended up getting a full-ride scholarship offer my junior year to a school called Grand Canyon University, and they're in Phoenix. And I signed with them and had the luxury of being a scholarship athlete going into my senior year of high school and decided to play football because what the heck, I had already secured the scholarship.
That's awesome. So how was that for you? Were you like team captain or were, you know, how did that work out for you, your senior year, baseball and football?
Yeah. So I think that, to go back in time, I don't think that I took baseball serious enough my senior year because I had already got the scholarship, and my head was really in football and trying to enjoy this opportunity to play football. Football, there's no other game like it, as you know, yeah, Stu, being a former football player yourself. I just loved it. I would dream about it. I didn't really dream about baseball very much. Loved being a pitcher, loved being on the mound, being able to control the defense and being that anchor for your team. But there is nothing like getting a handoff and getting that football in your arms and running down the sideline, trying to avoid tacklers or filling a gap as a linebacker and cracking pads with the running back right there at the line of scrimmage. There's no other game like it. It is phenomenal. But I just was never big enough, Stu, or fast enough to get considered for a legitimate scholarship in high school. So I played for fun, played for the love of the game, and really had a blast my senior year getting to play some football, man.
Nice, nice. So let's fast forward into college. So how did being a college athlete treat you?
It was tough when I first showed up down there. So I got a job as a server, and I was serving tables before I started my freshman year at Grand Canyon University. And I was playing in this summer league. And the summer league was an opportunity for freshmen and transfers and whatnot to prove themselves. So I earned a spot as our number one starter as a pitcher in the summer league. And my fastball was around 87 to 90 miles per hour. I had some good control, some good off speed, and I was having a successful summer. However, when the season started, my fastball dropped to about 80 miles an hour, and I couldn't throw more than about 20 pitches before it would start hurting. Mm. So I went through this whole process of going on the disabled list, off the disabled list, experimenting with everything from acupuncture to cortisone shots to lowering my arm slot. I've always been a worker. Hard work is what got me where I am today, but it can also be one of my number one problems too. Overworking and overuse can cause injuries. So I considered perhaps I had been doing too many drills and just throwing the ball too much and decided to take some more rest. And none of this works, Stu. And I decided that it was time to hang up the cleats. And this was after my freshman year at GCU. Thank the Lord I had my scholarship renewed, but it was time to move on.
All right. So what was next?
Well, my dad, I'll get into some personal stuff for our listeners out there. I think it's important as an operator and important as somebody on this podcast to put the ego aside and be transparent and share some of my failures so that I can help you guys improve in your course, in your life. And one of my largest failures as a kid was losing focus. My dad had a home building company in Florida, as you guys knew from early in the podcast, that's where I grew up. So he had been commuting back to Arizona to run this company. And my mom had got this hysterectomy operation when I was 16 years old, to rewind a little bit. And this operation almost killed her. She didn't respond well to it. She developed what's called hypothyroidism and tried all these different medications. She had adverse reactions to these medications. And so my dad ended up not being able to fly home to run his business. He had to stay in Arizona to take care of her. Right about that time, I graduated high school in 2007. So the 2008 recession hit, the Great Recession. And my dad, instead of being able to manage his funds, he had to take care of mom, and we ended up going bankrupt. And at the same time where we're going bankrupt and the Great Recession is happening, remember, I can't throw a baseball anymore. I've lost my gift. And I tried everything. So I'm starting to lose hope. I'm starting to lose focus. I fell in with a bad crowd. I got a fake ID and started gambling, smoking pot, doing things that I shouldn't do. And looking back on it to this day, if I didn't have those experiences and those failures, I would have never had the opportunity to have a pivot point. I would have never been in a place in my life where I look up to the sky and call to God for purpose and direction instead of just trying to do it all myself and kind of freestyle through this challenging world. We need purpose and we need direction so that we can have a clear path and guidance. And sometimes, whether it be somebody in particular in our life or whether it be God himself giving us that direction, we need a kick in the ass before we can get there. And I had got my greatest kick in the ass. It seemed that the entire world around me was falling apart. So I'll never forget, Stu, it was the summer of 2008. And like I said, I had a fake ID and I had read this book called The Black Belt in Blackjack on how to count cards. Well, I thought I was smart, but the problem with it is that you have to know how many decks that you start with so that you can know what your count is. And the casino I was going to had auto shufflers. So it was an infinite number of decks, and I had skipped over that part in the book. So I was getting my ass kicked to the point where I remember losing just about everything. And I had given gambling a couple weeks rest and just kind of tried to find myself in life. And I remember calling my dad and saying, hey, man, I don't want to go back up to Payson. I don't think it's healthy for me to go up there. There's some toxic people that I probably shouldn't be around, but I don't have anywhere to stay down here. Can you help me? And he says, well, we built this house in Paradise Valley and the bank foreclosed on it. It has no electricity, no running water, and no furniture, but I have a key and you can stay there. I said, okay. So I ended up staying at this house for a course of 2 weeks. And all it had in it was a love seat. And I don't want to get into the details of the things that I was doing in those 2 weeks, but I was struggling. And it was the lowest point in my life, Stu. And for our listeners out there, I decided to go to a casino one night and I lost it all. And I come back to this house and it's about, I want to say 2 a.m. And I remember just walking in the house and feeling sick to my stomach. For our listeners out there, if you guys have ever had your heart broken or you've ever lost a lot of money or whatever, you get sick to your stomach. And that's the way I felt. And I remember just deciding to go outside and I look up at the stars. And it was in that moment that I realized that God was listening to me. And I said, Lord, I don't care whatever it is you want me to do with my life. I'll do it. Tell me. And he responds to me with, how do you want me to tell you? And I said, okay, well, there's only one guy that I trust and one guy I'm talking to right now. That's my dad. Have him call me the precise moment that I wake up tomorrow and reveal your path to me. I'm a skeptic, Stu, so I need evidence. You know, I'm not a guy who kind of says, oh, that must be a sign. I need firm evidence. So I asked for it. And I'm not sitting here suggesting everyone out there do this. This was a very unique case in my life. If it happens and you have that opportunity, absolutely awesome. That's amazing. But this was a very unique stage in my life. And I feel that's why I was blessed to be able to get this. So I end up going back into the house and I curl up on this love seat. It's like 4 feet long. So I have one position I can sleep in, right? The curled up in a ball position. And I remember just thinking, dude, like it's over for you, you know, like you kind of this feeling of doom. And the way that we get through the pipeline, the way that we get through challenges in life is hope, hope that there's an end to suffering, right? So I didn't really have any of that hope. All of a sudden, I forgot about the prayer and I end up going to bed with this sick feeling in my stomach. Well, I wake up the next morning thinking, oh man, it's over for me. And all of a sudden I felt this rejuvenated feeling of hope. And I remember that prayer and that request. So I'm looking around for my phone. It was a BlackBerry. If you've got young listeners, Stu, they probably don't know what a BlackBerry is.
Yeah, old school.
looking around for this BlackBerry, and there's one pillow, and it's on the ground. I'm thinking, okay, that's where it's got to be. So I lift up the pillow, and the phone goes from being illuminated to dark, as if I had just received a phone call or a text. And I got pretty excited, but I'm thinking, you know, it can't be. So I pick up the phone. It's a missed call from my dad at 11:31 a.m. And being the skeptic that I am, I'm thinking, you know, he hadn't talked to him in a couple of weeks, but he's just calling me to check in. That's it. So I call him back. And Stu, before I can even say anything, he says, Jay, I got somebody who I want you to meet. He's down in Tucson, Arizona. His name is Chief Master Sergeant James Sanchez, and he's the chief of the 306 Rescue Squadron PJ team. And I knew right then and there that it was my purpose and my path to become a PJ.
All right. So that's a good little direction, focus.
Yes, sir.
That's an awesome story. I love it. Because we all have those journeys. You know, we always have something that just kicks us right in the nuts and, you know, we have to, we have to figure out our way or look for guidance, you know, and that's awesome. I love that story. So tell me this, just saying you want to be a PJ is different than preparing to be a PJ.
Right.
So what did you have to do that day to start your preparation?
Right. So the first thing is to isolate myself from my current environment and remove distractions. So I realized that I needed to change locations. And that location was to go back home with my dad. Now, I wanted to avoid that because my mom's condition and all of just the gloom and the negativity that was in the house because of the economic situation and her health. I wanted to avoid that so I could stay focused on baseball. But I realized that I needed to embrace it and get home and train with dad. So for about 2 months, dad would take me to the pool. And he would work with me on underwater swims, buddy breathing, equipment recoveries, things like that. Now, I had grown up snorkeling, but I had never learned how to swim properly. I had never learned how to do a double arm pull or a frog kick reset, keyhole stroke, nothing like that. So he didn't really necessarily know how to describe those types of things like you and I do for our students too. But sure, he at least knew how to tell me to keep a streamline, how to control my breathing and working those intervals. And I'll never forget the first 25 meter underwater I ever tried. I knocked it out and he goes, okay, freestyle back here. And he gives me a few minutes. He's like, do it again. I'm like, what? He says, do it again. And I remember getting down about halfway before I realized I was either going to pass out or have to come up for air. Only made it halfway down. So I really started off at the bottom, just like everybody else here that's listening to this podcast, or at least some of you guys that weren't Olympic swimmers before you came into the pipeline. Darn you guys.
Well, you know, everybody comes into this journey with a weakness. Amen. You know, whatever your athletic history is, it usually brings in some form of strength and some form of weakness. You know, and being an athlete is very helpful because you can pick up how to swim quickly, right? I teach athletes and I teach non-athletes, and the athletes are like, I say, do this, maybe show them how to do it, and then they pick it up. You know, whereas a non-athlete, it's, you know, they just got to get a little more comfortable with their body and understanding the movements, and it takes a little bit longer. But sounds like you're a natural athlete and you're learning these skills pretty quickly. Where else did you find other weaknesses along the way, whether it was, you know, some form of conditioning, you know, running, swimming, longer distances, lifting, calisthenics, you know, where were you when you first started?
Yeah, great question, Stu. The water confidence started getting taken care of, and it seemed like something that was fairly easy. Not necessarily easy, but I could see a success and good gains at that. It was easy to get those gains. You go in there, you work hard, you have a game plan, you get the gains. But for pull-ups, it was challenging for me because I had spent the 19 years of my life never really doing any heavy lifting for my back. It was all mobility, band exercises, working on explosion, and working on my core and my lower body. So I weighed 180 pounds, 6'1" before I was going into the pipeline, and my legs made up a lot of that weight. So it was very challenging for me to do pull-ups. I only did 8 pull-ups when I first started this thing. And when I actually did my pass test, I only could do 9 pull-ups. So to kind of fast forward a little bit, the PJ Indoc standard back in the day when they had PJ Indoc was 13 perfect dead hang pull-ups for the graduation standard. I barely made it with 14 pull-ups, but after years of the pipeline doing weighted pull-ups and strength conditioning programs, I got that number up to 30. It took years.
Oh, nice.
But it's doable.
Yeah. Oh yeah. That's really good. It does take time. You know, that's because here's what's happening that people don't really realize is that the pull-up is like the heavy weight training of calisthenics, right? It requires strength first,
right?
Right. To get your first pull-up requires strength. After that, you are slowly turning that strength exercise into an endurance exercise, you know, and right, becoming muscle stamina. And that's the hard part. Getting your first one, you know, it's not that bad. Getting your 30th one takes some time. So be patient with that journey. Did right. you find just increasing volume over time was the answer?
Really, the answer for me was good recovery. So not doing pull-ups every single day, but treating
number one,
it, right? Treating
good,
it more
good call
is yeah. a back workout. This is a back. I am sculpting my lats. I'm improving my grip strength, and I'm going to sequence this out throughout the week. Give myself a day or two of recovery. with pulling muscles and any type of pulling activity before I re-engage those muscles. That was the trick for me, adding weight. I liked having a dumbbell between my legs. I also liked having a vest on. Those are all just different ways to kind of change that focal point on where the weight is so that you can strengthen different muscles. So
I love it. That's good. So, okay. So on this day you said, okay, I'm going to be a PJ. And then you took some time to prepare for what you're going to endure. And it's, you know, it's nice to have a coach that knows what you're going to endure.
Right.
Very, very helpful. When was it, for how long was it before you were at boot camp? How long was that transition?
Yeah. So I spent two months up there in Payson with my dad. And then I changed my phone number, got a sponsor, to give me $300 a month to pay for my rent. And I found a room down in Tucson. So I was completely isolated from my environment, and I trained for 2 months straight for the 306 Rescue Squadron's entry test. And I'd go to LA Fitness to work on this swim and water confidence. It sucked because it was only a 4.5 foot pool, but you could at least work the surface stuff. So it took me about 2 months to get to where I could swim a 1500 meter swim freestyle in under 34 minutes. The test, you had to do a 3 mile run in under 21 minutes, your 7 minute pace, 10 pull-ups, 60 perfect push-ups, and 60 sit-ups. And then the test also had a couple 25-meter underwaters, a 3 mile ruck march, but these weren't for time. So it was what's called the AFSOC fitness test that I had to train for. It took 2 months, went to the 306 Rescue Squadron tryout. It was October 17th of 2008, and I shipped out to boot camp on October 28th of 2008.
Okay, so that's a really quick turnaround. I tell people all the time that your timeline to prepare before you ship out and join depends a lot on two things. One, your athletic history, right? Where, what you have been able to do. And the other one is just your ability to learn new skills quickly, right? So it sounds like you were on the fast track to get to PJ training.
Right, Stu, you bring up a really good point. If students haven't, or candidates haven't necessarily had any prior athletic experience or any movement experience per se, it's challenging for them to have that mind-body awareness. So you could tell them, this is how you do a perfect streamline. It's not like this, and tell them they need to roll their scaps up so they can alleviate any of that space. But they're not going to know how to actually do that movement because they haven't learned how to even engage those muscles yet. So it's a good point, Stu. I think athleticism definitely plays a big factor in coachability.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It just shortens the timeline. You know, yeah. I talk a lot about preparation, you know, preparing for this spec ops journey, no matter what that job is. You know, you got to get to the training by crushing a PT test, and you got to get through the training by training the specifics of your journey, of what your selection is going to look like. Right. And sometimes meeting those standards can take quite some time. You know, if you'd have been a football player in college, probably been a lot heavier. You know, I got a football player right now that's 280 pounds that's trying to lose 75 pounds, you know, before he even considers about, you know, joining, you know. So there's that timeline's going to be a little bit different, even though he's a great athlete. You know, there's circumstances that drive that timeline for you.
Yeah, great points, Stu. There's definitely certain sports where the athlete is more complementary to tactical athletics than not.
That's a good point. Let's name some of those. I have seen wrestlers do really well if they know how to swim, right? Amen. Wrestlers who know how to swim, lacrosse players do really well in selection programs.
Surfers who know how to run.
Surfers who know how to run, and lift. Yeah. I mean, it's no one particular sport that, you know, has a monopoly on success. You know, the variety of sports can, I've seen football players do really well as well, you know, so. Yeah. But let's move on. Let's talk a little bit about your pipeline journey. You know, how was that, you know, going through the Air Force training pipeline?
Yeah, PJN Doc, obviously that course is no more. They now have the ANS course for Air Force. It was a brutal course. It had a 90% attrition rate on paper. Since its existence, we started off with 90 guys and we graduated 15. It was a challenging course. The water confidence portion was every day. And that's really where we lost most of the guys. Now, mind you, there's people out there who are, they say, what's harder between Navy SEAL training and PJ training? Well, it's hard to really objectively state that on data, because in the past, the candidates that the Air Force got had no idea what they were getting into, versus preparation for BUDS has been out there on the internet. It's been out there publicly a little bit longer. So in my opinion, you saw guys in the past that were showing up to BUDS a little bit more prepared. And so that's maybe why you wouldn't see as high of an attrition rate on paper at BUDS. Well, we lost 30 guys in the first week just from 25 meter underwaters. And I would assume those 30 guys had never even been taught how to do those before. And obviously that's alleviated now because you have prep and sure, you're going to learn how to do an underwater swim right at prep. So that was my journey as far as NDOC goes. Like I said, I barely graduated the pull-up portion. Funny story, because my dad was a PJ, he called down to the schoolhouse.
Ooh, and he said, that's always helpful.
And he got a hold of a guy named Mike Maroney, who I've had on my podcast and is a great friend of mine to this day. And Mike was the, quote, mean instructor at NDOC. But he was only mean when he was in the pool. So he calls down, he says, hey, Mike, make sure my boy gets it as hard as we did when we went through. Mike goes, say no more. So I'll never forget, man. One day we're doing this drill called Ditch and Don. And this is where you got your 16-pound weight belt. You got your rocket fins on and you got your mask. And you got to tread water down at 10 and a half feet. I think it's 11 foot, 10 and a half feet, somewhere around there. Tread water for 1 minute. And then you got to descend down to the bottom of the pool. It's called a ditch and don. They line up the fins. Stu knows what I'm talking about. For listeners out there, line up the fins on top of each other. You got to be perfect. So if one foot cup is in front of the other or they're offset, it's a failure. You got to put the mask right on top of the fins and then lay that 16-pound weight belt right on top. And it's got to be an inspection order. There's like a four-step inspection criteria, right? So I go down there and I get my gear off and I'm just thinking, oh, dude, this sucks, but I'm going to do like a last minute check just to make sure it's good to go. I check it real quick. I come up. And I'm like, yeah, I got that one. So afterwards, you got to tread. And then you tread for, I think, another minute and a half. And then you dive down and you don your gear, put it back on.
And that's on a breath hold, too.
That's on a breath hold, guys. It's a tough exercise because your heart rate's screaming by the time you even dive down under the water and you have tasks to do. So I never forget Mike Maroney. I look down. I'm treading, right? And this is after I ditch my gear, right? Rewind. And I'll never forget, he comes down to my gear and he starts messing with it. And then he pops up out of the water. He goes, sweet, math behind foot cup failure. And I just look at him and I wanted to back talk, which is a no-no, but I was just like, no, don't back talk, Mr. Maroney. So I'm just thinking there, oh man, I got to do a ditch and don again. Cause if you fail ditch and don the first time, you got to do it again the second time. And it's never easier the second time because your heart rate's already jacked. So I go in a second time and this time I know I got it right. Maroney comes up again, sweet, math behind foot cup failure. And this time I was like, negative, sir, which was a big no. And he goes, what? And I, at that point, I didn't say anything. And he goes, sweet, your dad prepared you for this course. And I was like, negative, sir. And he said, that's bullshit. Don't throw your dad under a bus like that. And he started getting under my head. Now, everybody in the class, all 18 dudes that were left, were sitting there watching me. I was the only one in the pool. So it was a very humbling experience. And I had to go down and do it a third time. And what I learned from that is, number one, you got to play the game. Have confidence in yourself. Sometimes you just have to survive. Number two, you never backtalk an instructor. Never backtalk an instructor. Number three, get it right the first time, guys. You know, even if maybe I did get it wrong, let's say that I did. Okay. The moral of the story is get it right the first time so you don't have to go through hell again. Right, Stu?
Yeah, man. I have a similar story with drown proofing. You know, when they tie your feet together and they tie your hands together. Yeah. My test, I nailed it the first time, but as I was finishing the last event, you have to pick up your mask with your teeth from the bottom of the pool and you swim to the edge. And while I was swimming to the edge, the rope around my foot came undone. An instructor just brings it right over to me and goes, fail. Right.
Oh, man. Completely out of your control.
And I fail. And so I just had to do it again, you know, right afterwards. It's like a 30-minute test, you know, and your eyes are like bleeding because it's, you know, so much chlorine in it, not quite bleeding, but they just burn. So I had to do it again. And I did it the second time, but I was exhausted afterwards. In fact, I remember walking, I couldn't even look because I had to hold on to my buddy who was in front of me while we were marching because I couldn't see. You know, it was just like my eyes were all messed up for the next couple of hours.
They had those chlorine levels jacked up, huh?
Oh, man, I don't know what it was. But anyway, you're right. Finish it right the first time. Do it right. Pay attention to detail. Follow the procedures. All of those things come into play, you know, especially if you want to get it done the first time.
Amen.
So that's a great story. So that's a hell of a, you know, NDOC story. So after NDOC, you know, any other issues before you were at your team?
Yeah. So issues, I failed the EMT National Registry paramedic test. Part of being a PJ, as you guys know, is being a civilian recognized paramedic. So you have to go through this course. And the test is challenging. It's one of those tests where if you fail one block of the test, you fail the whole thing. And I had never developed good study habits in high school. I was a bit unfocused, more thinking about baseball scholarships and such than working on my academics. Had never developed good study habits or note-taking skills. So that was a real ass kicker for me. Not only did I fail it once, I failed it twice. And in between each failure, you had to do 3 weeks of remediation. But again, for our listeners out there, failure can be a great thing. There's a saying out there, I don't lose. I either win or I think it's, I don't fail. I either win or I don't remember. So,
I remember something like that. Maybe it's like, it's not a failure. It's a learning experience.
Yeah, there you go.
I don't win or lose. It's a learning experience.
I never lose. I either win or I fail. Whatever it is. But that was a big thing for me, Stu, was learning how to develop good study habits. And I ended up being able to get a degree in biochemistry later on in my life, which was the hardest thing I've ever done, by the way. But I credit it to what I learned from that failure during that EMT paramedic national registry test. So ended up taking care of business there, moved on to Halo School. After Halo School, went back to Kirtland Air Force Base for the pararescue apprentice course. This is the final phase of our two-year pipeline. It's a six-month course where we tie everything together as well as add things like mountaineering and ropes and tactics, et cetera. And ropes was very challenging for me. I had never picked up a carabiner before, and it seemed like a lot of PJs didn't necessarily do athletics as much as I did. They were more into exploring, climbing, doing outdoor types of activities, things like that. So a lot of these guys had tied ropes before or tied knots before. They had experimented with ropes. They had worked with carabiners, and I didn't even know how to open a tri-locking carabiner when somebody first gave it to me. So that was very challenging for me. I realized that I either needed to get this and catch up to speed, or I was going to get set back, and I didn't want that. So I ended up spending a lot of time with some of my teammates that were better at me, which was everybody at tying knots after hours. And to rewind a little bit, at combat dive school, Stu knows all about this. For our listeners out there, you do this exercise called one-man competency. It's where the instructors surge off the wall. They throw you all around the water and they rip your regulator out of your mouth and they tie it onto your steel manifold in these series of knots. And you can strike these knots, right? You can undo them. You put your regulator back in your mouth, purge the regulator, start breathing, one breath, and then the instructor surges you again, knocks you all over the place, rips your regulator out of your mouth, ties it. Now, over the course of this 10 minutes for our listeners, you have to recognize what's called a whammy knot. And this is a knot that you cannot untie, okay? It's not strikeable. Once you identify the unstrikeable knot, you ditch your tanks, pull them over your head, put your mouth up to your steel manifold, and you start breathing out of your regulator. Now, if you do what's called a premature ditch, so you're starting to get hypoxic, you're freaking out, you think, oh, that's definitely the whammy knot, and you pull your tanks off, you're going to know that you did a premature ditch because the instructor is going to throw a regulator in your mouth. So I failed one-man competency the first time and the second time, and you get three tries at it. You get two tries on Friday. And if you don't get it, you have to wait all weekend before you try again on Monday. And then you got to do your two-man competency evaluation after that. So I'll never forget, our listeners out there, this is important. Be this guy. Okay. Not me. Be this guy I'm about to tell you about. There's a guy named Barry Creel. And for those who've seen Inside Combat Rescue, not a big fan of the show. I feel like they kind of made us look like flight nurses more than combat search and rescue personnel. But for those who have seen that show, check out Barry Creel. Barry and I were at combat dive school together, and we had this set of practice tanks up in the classroom. Both of us were under 21, so we couldn't go out with the boys on the weekend anyway. So these practice tanks had a steel manifold, regulators on them, and Barry had figured out how to tie the whammy knot and how to tie some of these knots that the instructors were doing. And he had me put the tank on, sit on the ground and close my eyes and basically dirt dive the whole situation and imagine myself being there for 10-minute increments as he just helped me work these knots. And because Barry helped me that weekend, I was able to go out and crush one-man comp on Monday. So guys, be a great teammate. Yep. You know, never hesitate to sacrifice some time to help somebody that you foresee would be a good operator make those standards.
Yeah, that's a really good point. The weekends were great times to play catch up on some of those skills. Like you're not going to work out and get stronger or faster or anything like that. I mean, that's not what the weekend's for. It's to lick your wounds and try to pick up some skills that are taught to you at a very steep learning curve. So sometimes a little extra credit studying will definitely help you on that.
Right.
Wow. That's a really good one. Yeah. I remember that we called it pool comp back then. Now they call it OC8 at Open Circuit 8 at Bud's.
That
event. Yeah. In second phase. And it's a crusher. It's tough. And if you can get it right the first time, that's the key. All right. So tell me this, was there a particular time in the pipeline where you were, or especially in the NDOC when there's a really high attrition rate, was there a particular time when you said, man, I got this? Or was there ever a doubt in your head that you didn't have this? You know, it's like, hey, I can do this.
Every single day I woke up and told myself I can do this. Every single day. Now, as far as doubts go, I must admit, whenever I saw myself only doing 10 pull-ups on week one, and I realized final eval standards was 13, and I needed to gain 4 pull-ups to beat that eval standard, I felt some pressure. I wouldn't say doubt, but I realized that I needed to do something here, and I needed to go above and beyond. So I definitely felt pressure. I knew that this was my path. This was my calling. So there was no question of why or if. It was a question of doing doing it, period. I'm going to fulfill my purpose. I'm going to drink this cup that's been placed in front of me. Therefore, there was no option. It was die or graduate. And I know that sounds cliche, but it's, we had these, you guys do Hell Week. We do this thing called Extended Training Day, and it's 2 nights of rough sleep, basically no sleep. And they do 4 water con sessions throughout these 2 nights of no sleep, and regular training days turn up the heat on you. And I'll never forget, we were doing this exercise called the 10 up. So we would do a series of push-ups. They'd make us hold the down position, the up position. Then we'd have to dive down into the pool. We'd have to swim underwater, touch the bottom of the pool on the other side, push off, come back up, immediately go into push-up position. Half the team's on one side, half the team's on the other. So you'd have collisions as the team dives into the pool. And I'll never forget, I look over to my left and I look over to my right, and I see this guy, Sam Turner, and he's the toughest dude on the team. And Sam's crying. He's not, you know, he doesn't look like he's, you know, he's crying because he lost. He's crying with this determined look in his face, as if, you know, it's like physical anguish. And I remember just seeing that, all of a sudden I start freaking crying, and I look over to the guy on my left, this dude's freaking crying. So here you have these grown ass men that are so physically broken down, mentally exhausted, sleep deprived, food deprived, that they are crying, but have a look of determination. I'll never forget it. It was one of the most empowering things. And I knew right there that nobody from this group was going to quit, and everyone from this group was going to make it. And they did.
That's awesome. Yeah. There are all those little moments where, you know, you just see the determination in everybody's face, and whether it's, blood, sweat, tears, or whatever that's coming out, they will definitely keep driving on no matter what.
Yeah,
that's a good point. So you got through the pipeline and you now go to your squadron. What was that transition like? You're a new guy again. What's that like?
Well, it was a big eye opener. To go from the pipeline to getting to your team is incredible, especially when you get that standard issue for the first time, enough gear that you can fill up a garage and you're picking the optics on your weapon and where you want your Surefire, and you're getting sized for your oxygen mask for Hey-Ho and Halo jumps and getting all your crypto loaded up on your radio. It's just an incredible feeling getting to your team. But the most amazing part about it was that my dad was actually in the pipeline at the same time that I was, because he re-enlisted. Okay, to rewind a little bit, things didn't really work out for us too well because of that great recession and mom's operation. And my dad ended up going back into the Air Force to serve as a PJ at the same unit as me. So Chief Sanchez hits up dad and he says, "Hey, Mo, what do you think about going back in?" And dad starts laughing. He's like, "Come on, man, I'm 40 years old." So long story short, dad ends up getting back in shape and he's 40. I think he's 41, almost 42 at the time. He goes, "Hey, son," he goes, "I'm going back in." I mean, you got to be kidding. He goes, "Yeah, dude, I'm going back in. I'm passing the AFSOC test right now. I'm going to go down and test." So he ended up going down there doing the same tryout as me. He passed it and they ship him off. And he and I would have graduated in the same PJ apprentice course class, but he failed National Registry. Didn't find out about it until later. And they had to fly him back to Boise, Idaho to rehack National Registry. He took care of business. But the paramedic course that he took was like 3.5 months long. It was insane. So it was a tough course for him, but he took care of business, graduated in the course after me. So after, I want to say, 3 months of being on team at the 306th in Tucson, here comes my dad and we've got berets together. So that was pretty incredible, being able to serve with my dad. There was a lot of regulations on what we could and couldn't do. Chief was able to kind of slide past those and slip through the cracks a little bit to get us some jumps together. And the way he was able to do that was to get lift tickets at Skydive Arizona and have us jump on civilian aircraft together instead of military aircraft. So I actually have some film of it. I may post it one day.
Fun. That's awesome.
Doing our last, doing Chief's last jump, but my dad and I's only jump together.
Oh, man, that's gold.
Yeah. Yeah, man. So Ops Tempo was big. This was 2012. I graduated April 19th of 2011. So Helmand Province, up in Bagram, northeastern Afghanistan, Kandahar, it's really going down for PJs. And you know that after you throw that maroon beret on, they're getting you ready for war and they're getting you ready for a deployment in Afghanistan. So that was very exciting for me. Everyone joined to do this, or at least I hope that that's what they joined to do, to go serve their country in combat and really go put their training to the test. So being able to train for Afghanistan and immediately graduate and go into this pre-deployment spin up was phenomenal. I mean, everything from driving courses to advanced SEER courses, to close quarter combat schools that were put on by Delta Force and SEAL Team 6 operators at abandoned New Mexico State Penitentiary. We did canopy control courses where we would knock out 100 jumps in a course over 2 weeks. It was just amazing what we would do. So with that being said, we had to deploy. So we ended up going to Helmand. We got tasked to Helmand Province, Afghanistan, down at Camp Bastion / Camp Leatherneck. And that was 2012. So it was a 6-month tasking, but there were so many PJs on our team that wanted to go that they had to split the tasking into two. And so they gave 2 3-month taskings. So I had the second half tasking. Went out there on March 15th of 2012, got to be a part of a very exclusive team that I don't think that it still exists anymore, but this was called the Guardian Angel Tactical Response Team. And it was essentially a CASAVAC platform that also provided QRF relief. It was attached to not just the C-130, which used to be a tasking called Fever, but it was also tasked to other aircraft, including CV-22s and whatnot. So it opened up the mission spectrum a little bit more, ended up going on a 12-day mission to Pakistan, could talk to you guys more about that in person, and then got back to Afghanistan and ended up doing the casualty evacuation rotation. sometimes we would do up to 2-3 missions a day, pulling guys off the battlefield. Sometimes they were just FOB to FOB transports. Sometimes they were just regular transports, everything from 9-year-old Afghani boys to British recon, to SEALs, Green Berets, 82nd Airborne, you name it. I mean, if they were out there and they were fighting the good fight, we'd come for you.
Man, that's an incredible mission. For those who aren't really aware of what Air Force PJs do, I mean, they are, what is the motto of the PJ?
These things we do that others may live.
Yes. Incredible. Incredible motto.
You know, Stu, sorry to interrupt you.
No.
As a PJ, it's a little conflicting because you want a mission so bad, naturally. But in order for the terms to line up for you to get launched on that mission, it has to be the worst day of somebody's life.
Yeah.
So I used to say this prayer when I was in Afghanistan, and the prayer was, Lord, I pray that nobody gets hurt today, but given the nature of this country, it's going to happen. And if and when it does, I pray that you send me.
That love it. Love it. And your podcast that you have is also called, you send know, with me. The SOCOM athletes, called Send Me. And yes, it's after the Bible verse in Isaiah, right?
That's correct. Isaiah's.
Go ahead and share that one.
Yeah. Isaiah 6:8 says, then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send and who will go for us? And I said, here I am, send me.
Oof. Love it.
Love it.
Love it. Beautiful. All right. So how many years was that? Were you in the operational capacity, and when did you decide to get out of the military?
Yeah, so that was in 2012. I ended up finishing up in October of 2014. So I got back from Afghanistan. I'd been active orders for about 4 years or so. And then I got, I requested to be put on traditional reservist orders. So I would come in part-time. I would do spin-ups. I would have to maintain my HALO pay, scuba pay, jump pay, flight hours. I had to do X amount of situational medical exercises a year. So I would end up coming in a couple times a week, sometimes for 2-week periods at a time during the month. But I went over to Pima Community College to actually give my college baseball career another shot and start progressing towards potentially being a doctor. So I was taking 15 credits over at Pima Community College and walked on their baseball team and got to play a little baseball again.
Nice.
In 2013.
So you went back to be a collegiate athlete again. And what happened through that? Did you wind up finishing school?
I was only throwing about 84 miles an hour. I was in the rotation as a relief pitcher, but most of the pitchers on our staff were guys that were throwing 90, 93 and had gotten either a low draft pick out of high school or they didn't have good grades. And so they wanted to spend a year at a community college, getting their grades up before they transferred to a 4-year school or getting a little bit of improvement so they could get a better draft stock and get some more money that year. So the competition was enormous there at that school. But besides the competition, I wasn't throwing a fastball like I used to. And being a pitcher, in my opinion, isn't nearly as fun unless you can bring the heat. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's true.
I never quit anything in my life. I wouldn't necessarily consider this quitting, but I didn't finish something that I started. So I went to the coach and I said, Coach, I pursued this to potentially have another shot at playing baseball professionally or collegiately and having a career. It's not working out for me. I'm spending 6 hours a day with you guys. I want to go back to working as a PJ and really focusing on my academics. So I decided to hang the cleats up for good. That was it. And I ended up working as a PJ more, really working on getting promoted to E5 and becoming a team leader. Ended up getting on what's called a prog tour, as well as some annual tours and clumping those orders in together and being a full student at the same time.
Nice.
I ended up getting an associate's degree at Pima Community College and then transferring over to the University of Arizona as a junior. And this was in 2013. And I had met my wife now, Jessica, at the time. And I was over at her house. And I don't remember what we were doing or how we got on this conversation. But I remember saying, honey, what would you think about me trying out for the U of A football team? And she's like, what? And I was like, well, I know you don't know this part of my life because we didn't meet until I was a new PJ. But football has always been my dream, and I never had the shot physically to do it. and I think that I could walk on the U of A football team. And Jessica's roommate was dating the second string running back, DJ. And I remember talking to DJ and him just being like, man, you can do this. Like, here's the process. So I don't know how, but the rumor kind of got out there a little bit that I was interested in walking on the U of A football team. And so our commander, our wing commander named Colonel Maxwell, great man, by the way, full bird colonel at the time. He's retired now. And he said, hey, man, you know, I got some connections with you. You know, if you want to try out, I'll get you a tryout. And I was like, okay, sounds good, Colonel. And I remember training for about a year, Stu. And we kind of talked about shifting from baseball shape to PJ shape. Well, now it's shifting from PJ shape to Division I running back, slot receiver, weak side linebacker, wherever they want to take me type shape. And that was tough.
Yeah, that's a different animal.
It was tough becoming an explosive power athlete versus an endurance, well-rounded triathlete type is a PJ. Took me a year to really transform my body. I had to eat perfect. I had to have a perfect game plan, work out almost twice a day, do yoga, foam rolling, recovery methods. I mean, you name it. It was really my life. And I dedicated it for a year. Went and tried out. And I had hired a speed coach to administer mock combines for me. So I had a really good idea of what my 40 time, my vertical leap, my shuttle run, 5'10", 5 pro agility was going to be going in. And I knew that I was going to make the team based on these numbers. So I end up actually getting cut, Stu. And I ran a 5 flat 40 yard dash time. And this was after consecutively running the 40 yard dash in 4.67 seconds. So I thought that I was going to be one of the faster linebackers on the team. But when I tried out, I wasn't even fast enough to make the team. So they cut me and it broke my heart, man. I mean, I remember I had about 6 months left as a PJ. And after I got cut, I decided to take this slot for this rescue jump master course down in Cocoa Beach Air Force Base, Florida. And I go down there and God rest their souls, man. They're not with us today. They died in the Jolly 51 helicopter crash. But Carl Enos and Bill Posh had kind of heard about what happened, you know? And I told them, nah, man, you know, I'm not going forward with football. And they were like, dude, you had one bad day. Like, you should try out again. And so they set up cones for me. And a guy named Peterson as well, Grant Peterson, he set up cones for me as well. And they were tying me in the 40. And I was like 4.9, 4.9, you know, I'm just like, dude, that's not a good enough time. I was lifting, kind of just getting my mind back while I was there at RJM. And I got invited back to try out at the U of A. And I went out there and I ran a 4.8 flat and a 4.82 on my 2 40-yard dash times. So not the best times ever, but good enough to get their attention on the one-on-ones. I did pretty well, tried to display some physicality. My footwork needed a lot of work, but they ended up picking me up. I'll never forget it, man. I just, you know, you think that you have this vision in your head of what it's going to be like when you graduate this task or when you get the call or whatever. And you think, you know, it's going to be this amazing moment where you celebrate. But it kind of felt like so past due and so humbling to me. And it was so much that all I could think about was let's get to work, dude. There was no time to celebrate. It was let's get to work.
I love it.
The phone call. He says, hey, Jay, we picked you up, but if I ever catch you not going 100%, I'm going to cut your ass as quick as I picked you up on this football team. So that was my order, man. Go hard.
Damn. You know, it's funny because I did some research just before, you know, we had this conversation and, you know, I saw that you were, you know, Arizona football player. And throughout this whole journey, I was like, he's not a football player. What was I thinking? I must have read something wrong in this whole process. But finally, you made it to be a Arizona football player. So, that is some ups and downs and left and right hand turns throughout this whole journey. So what is it that you studied at Arizona?
Biochemistry.
Biochemistry, huh?
Right. So unfortunately, Stu, I ended up getting some playing time my redshirt freshman year. So almost immediately after getting on the team, I got put on kickoff and kickoff return, which I got fired, by the way. We were 5-0 and we were ranked 10th in the country, played against USC at home, lost by a field goal. I laid a complete egg on special teams, didn't do anything. Coach Rod fired just about everybody off special teams. And I didn't even see the depth chart until the last game of the season against ASU in November. So that was pretty rough. But after getting fired off special teams, I got obsessed with becoming a better football player to the point where it really got out of balance. And I started sacrificing and pulling from everything else in my life to gain more time to be a football player, which is a problem for our listeners out there. You have to maintain the balance in your life. So what ended up happening was I ended up doing 3-a-day practices and on my own. And I also changed my major. I did these 3-a-day practices, and one day I was playing basketball with some of my teammates, getting some cardio in, and I went up for this dunk on a fast break, and I got fouled and came down twisted, tore my ACL and meniscus. Had never had any tears, never had a surgery, but I knew right away it was over for me. So ended up having a great response to the surgery. I got cleared to play after 5.5 months of grueling physical therapy, expedited recovery. But what enabled me to do that, Stu, was I proactively changed my major from biochemistry to general studies, which I thought was a smart move, but I didn't consult anyone. I just did it myself online. The problem is that if you are going to be a sophomore academically, you also have to be a sophomore eligibility-wise as an athlete. So what I did in changing my major was I made myself ineligible, because even though this was an easier degree, a bunch of the 100 level requirements for the course I hadn't taken yet. So I ended up making myself ineligible after getting my ACL recovery. So that was a tough one for me, a very emotional experience. So the U of A football thing kind of ended as quick as it started. Spent a year playing ball. We got to play in the Fiesta Bowl. We are ranked 10th in the country most of the year. Won 3 games in the fourth quarter decision, had the fans rush us a couple of times. It was incredible. I thank God for that experience, and I'm so grateful. But definitely made some bad moves that prevented me from really potentially having a good college football career. So for our listeners out there, don't overtrain, stay focused, and maintain the balance in your life. You know?
Yeah, I tell you what, I tell people all the time, if you're in, you know, if you're a few months away from shipping out or you're in season or whatever, you really have to watch the extracurricular activities that you're doing, like pick up basketball or jujitsu or MMA, you know, just little things that can get you injured, you know, because I had one of my best guys ever, you know, had to drop his orders because he broke his hand, you know, doing an MMA fight, you know, just Friday night lights, you know, Friday night fights and just playing around. And, you know, he's still not in, you know, he still hasn't fully recovered yet. You know, so those are things that you have to really start taking seriously when things are getting close, you know, when it matters. If you got a whole year or so, you know, an accident happens, you can probably recover from and come back to it, you know, depending on the severity of it. So you had a little bit of a different transition in and out of the military. You know, a lot of people do that. A lot of people go in young, get the GI Bill to help them pay for college, or they, you know, they go on and play some college athletics that they'd never done, you know, never thought of, like right out of high school. That's a very unique journey there. So what happened after college? What was next after that?
Oh, by the way, Steve, I remember that Fraser. It's I don't fail, I either win or I learn.
There you go. I love that. Yeah.
So, after I dealt with this ACL tear and all of that, I ended up getting plugged in with a professor at the University of Arizona named Dr. Ricardo Valerdi. And we collaborated on this project called the DOD/NCAA Mind Matters Challenge. And the project was a research/grant effort to develop a educational training aid that would change the culture of college football players to start reporting their concussions after having them. So this really led me into the human performance world and the world of grants and proposals and research. Human performance wasn't really even talked about at the time. It wasn't really a thing. And it's culminated and evolved over the years and into what it is now. But this was really kind of the beginning of that. So what we ended up doing was developing this phone app that worked in virtual reality. So the way that it was compatible with virtual reality is you guys can look up Google Cardboard. It only costs about $3 per unit when bought in bulk. And it simply has splitter lenses on it. And you slide your phone through it and hold it up to your face. And now whatever application you're running on your phone, you can see it essentially in virtual reality. So I took lead on this project, ended up getting kind of promoted from a researcher to taking lead on it. And we came up with the name Brain Games. And my job was to develop the curriculum for the app, as well as promote it on social media, make sure that it was realistic, get any type of consultation from football players to make sure that, you know, the football players looked right, the coaches looked right, et cetera. So what the app ended up being was a virtual reality scenario where we took a drone back before people knew what drones were in the University of Arizona Stadium. And we turned it from 3D to virtual reality. And we screened myself and Scooby Wright, who was Defensive Player of the Year at the time, into this virtual reality app. And you would catch punts in Arizona Stadium, you as the user, catch punts in Arizona Stadium, get hit by Scooby, experience in virtual reality one of five of the most common grade two concussion symptoms. Okay, grade two being a concussion where you don't go unconscious, but you're symptomatic. You would experience one of those five symptoms, and then you would experience what it was like to catch punts with that symptom. So with our research, we realized that with fight or flight, there's no way that these athletes, when they're in the heat of battle per se, are going to be able to make a calculated decision for their health over a long term. They're going to do what they feel is right in the heat of battle, which means to stay in and compete. Yep. However, in my opinion, and what I pushed for this app was that if the athletes are able to see that they would hurt their team because their performance is going to be drawn back, that would prompt the athlete to have the integrity to let their backup come in. Because number one, they know it's going to hurt their health. Number two, they know it's going to hurt their team. So that was the app. We ended up winning the contest and getting funded. And that led me into some other research initiatives to where I ended up doing a lot of work for other people, helping them win funding for their initiative. And I realized the necessity of kind of starting my own initiative, which led me to SOCOM Athlete quickly after graduating college.
Nice. So SOCOMAthlete.com, right? Yes, is where people can find it. That's what you're doing now. Explain a little bit about what SOCOM Athlete is and the programs that you have coming out of SOCOM Athlete.
Whenever I was playing football, I started developing a social media presence, and in having this presence would receive messages from guys that had questions, everything from recruiting and LASIK eye surgery, PRK, because they got disqualified, to I am considering being a combat controller and attack P. I don't know the difference. Can you help me decipher that? To I live in Miami and I have nobody to train with. Do you know anyone around here that is training for SOF? And over time getting these messages, I started this Instagram page, and the Instagram page was dedicated to volunteering and just helping guys prep. But the main focus was placing people into networks in their region to help them find other people to train with. And over the course of a few years and kind of tying my human performance research into this and doing some one-on-one training and hosting some hell day type events back in the day, I realized that the group chats were very necessary. And what I mean by the group chats is over time, I developed a application. So a questionnaire where you could apply to be put in these regional based special operations group chats. And we started off with about 30 or 40 guys spread out across the country, five guys in San Antonio, 12 in San Diego, 20 in Arizona, where I had lived at the time. And I kind of helped these guys by giving them free workouts, helped them, taught them how to plan and conduct training and schedule and communicate. And over time, they just kept growing, growing, growing. And 3.5 years later, we have 36 group chats with over 1,200 members, and they are all training for special operations, getting after it.
Nice. I love it. Yeah, that's a beautiful thing that you're doing, and it's needed, you know, especially during that preparation phase that a lot of people unfortunately skip because they think they need to join immediately in order to get that kind of preparation. And then, right. You know, and most jobs, you know, you really have to go in at a high level. It's most spec ops jobs, you really have to go in at a high level already in order to meet the standards, exceed the standards, be a competitive candidate. And if you're going into a course that has, I always say this, if you're going into a course that has an 80% attrition rate, you want to be in the top 20%.
Right.
I mean, it just rules of mathematics, right? You want to be in the top 20% of everything. And doing that is really required of your preparation. So you are in the business of preparing spec ops candidates, and you also have these events. Explain some of your events that you do, the live training right. events.
What I realized, Stu, is that most people can learn to develop the strength and conditioning side if they dedicate themselves enough to it. It's out there. But the main struggle that I saw with a lot of candidates was mindset. And so I shifted SOCOM Athlete from the human performance side and kind of the physical preparatory side to helping develop mindset, communication, leadership skills, grit, insight, affirmation that this career and this path that you want to do is truly for you. The idea of these Hell Day events is, okay, you guys got this group chat. You guys are a family now. You're meeting, you're hanging out, you're working together. I'm going to come to your town and see what you're all about. So a few years ago, I found some logs and was able to procure some rubber training rifles, and I'm a PJ. So I got all my medical equipment and whatnot. And I traveled on out to San Diego, California, teamed up with the Air Force recruiters out there and some Navy guys, and threw a Hell Day event over at Naval Air Station North Island. So it was a PT test. We gave them some career information, did some Q&A. We did some log PT, put them out in the Pacific a little bit to hit them in the surf. Really just worked with them on what it would be like to be a candidate for a day in special operations. And Hell Day has evolved from that to what it is now.
No, that's awesome, because I tell you, you know, you're right. There are some things that you can do in those events that really test your want to, right? As a candidate, you know, there are these little gut checks that, you know, there's going to be a little voice talking to you, you know, when you're cold and wet and tired and just feeling miserable. That you have to have an answer to, you know, of why you are doing this to yourself, because that little voice in your head is saying, what are you doing? This is stupid, right? Why are you hurting yourself like this? You know, either that voice is turned off completely and you don't hear it, or if it does appear, you have to have a solid answer. And sometimes you don't get those answers until you're put in that situation.
Stu, there's a lot of wisdom in that statement you just said. Something that I tell cross trainees and older guys in particular is that the things that you'll do in the pipeline, they don't make sense physically. Some of them are dangerous. Some of them could perceivably take your oxygen away to where you can no longer breathe. And your body, that doesn't make sense to your body. It doesn't make sense, right? Well, if you are an analytical thinker, and you have had a lot of responsibilities in your life, maybe you run a business, you're a math guy, you have a wife and kids and a dog and mortgages, you're going to think through things analytically. You're going to be a bit more cautious. You're going to be a bit more calculated. So the older you get, the longer you wait, the more organized, the more in business you get, perceivably your mindset could get weaker as a special operations candidate. Sometimes it's best to be that guy that lowers your horns down and blows through the door in selection. Now, once you finish selection and you start getting into the technical aspect, that can change when you get into the mission planning and the execution phase. But that's a big thing, Stu, is guys kind of thinking, well, this doesn't make sense. You have to trust the curriculum, your instructors, and the process that it's going to be safe, and just do it. Don't think about it. Just do it.
Yeah, you know, that's a really good point. I have seen it, you know, the age window, or it's really, if you look at it, it's kind of like an age barn door to be able to serve in special ops. You got your 17-year-olds that would get parental permission, you know, to join, and then you got the 29-year-old who is like touching the top of the age limit, right? And it's a bell curve, right? It is a bell curve of success. You know, and you know, a lot of your younger guys just aren't physically equipped yet, and a lot of your older guys are just like you just said, a little bit too analytical in their thinking of like, well, I can always go back to this because I was, you know, I was making a good living back then, or you know, I really
Yeah,
don't want to
that
hurt.
backup plan.
Yeah, they had that backup plan, you know. But the guys in the middle really hadn't got their career started, really hadn't got their life started yet, but they're still out of puberty. You know, they're actually a man, you know, an adult, and you know, they tend to do a little better at that curve there. So anyway, that's just some of my observations over the years. So with that, so that's what you're doing now. What does it look like for you in the future? Like what's the next 5 years hold for Jason Sweet and SOCOM Athlete?
Yes, to we've been working with the government lately, particularly recruiting and scouting organizations. So 320th Special Forces Group, Air Force Special Warfare Recruiting, the Basic Reconnaissance Course, and the Recon Sniper Foundation. And what they will essentially do is sponsor these hell days if they like the idea. And I pitch it to them, propose it to them. They sponsor the hell day so that they can come to the event, support the event, and scout and recruit. Because every single one of these guys have to go through a recruiter eventually, number one. Number two, those recruiters are ultimately looking for young men and women that can do these jobs, A, and that B are going to meet the criteria, whether it be passing the PASS test, PFT, PST, or being able to medically qualify through MEPS. So I can't put them through a medical screener at Hell Day, but the recruiters can come out and literally see firsthand the mindset, the communication, leadership, and the physical ability of these students that are going to the event. So the event, to kind of tie back to athletics, is almost a showcase when it comes to the recruiters, but when it comes to the students, this is an actual day in special operations preparation simulated to them where they are helping getting their mindset developed. And it's usually not the physical challenges that Hell Day students struggle with. It is the attention to detail. It's having an equipment list, strict timelines, entering the water procedures, got to hold three fingers on the mask, two simulating holding regulator in your mouth, look left, right, down, horizon, step with your left foot, fists up in the air, I feel fine, sir, two pumps from the chest, these types of things. Maybe one person comes up with their left fist because they're physically exhausted or they're thinking too much or they just didn't pick that part up. Maybe they struggle with attention deficit and it's hard for them to pay attention to something and let it sink. Maybe they struggle communicating with people. And whenever they tell somebody to pick the log up, they sound like an asshole and nobody responds to it. I mean, those are just examples of things that
Those
they're
are
going to
great.
get by coming to this event. Again, it's to build mindset and affirmation. You should finish this event with a new sense of fire and a new sense of affirmation that special operations is for you. Your shoulders rolled back, your head high, knowing the direction you need to go. But some finish the course with their shoulders rolled forward and their head down, knowing, man, this is not for me. I'm glad I was here, but this is not for
But
me.
you know what? It's a success then as well. You know what I mean? It's successful for that person to make that decision and not waste, you know, anybody else's time or their own time, you know, going down that journey. You know, there are other options for that person to do, and that's why I like those kind of gut check training programs like you're doing, is just because it offers that valuable lesson. And what you've added to it with bringing in recruiters and, you know, special ops recruiters specifically, is here's what's going to happen. You go there and you're a good recruit. Let's say you're crushing the PASS test or the PST, you know, and then you do real well in this. You know what you have done there as a candidate is you just let that recruiter know that you're a serious candidate. And you know what? They're going to work with you so much more than if you go there and you fail the PST and you fail any other objective training criteria. Because that's what a lot of people do, especially within the Navy process, is they join too early. They've never even done a 500-yard swim before in their life. And now they got to learn how to swim. They got to learn how to take this PST. And for months, all they do is fail PSTs.
Right.
And nobody takes them seriously. So you're either going to go there on your first PST and you're going to be in the passing group, or you're going to be in the failing group. And you got to think of that as a job interview. This is your job interview to probably the first SEAL or special ops guy you've ever met before.
Yeah.
Right. And where do you want to be? You'll be in the passing group or the failing group.
Right.
And programs like SOCOM Athlete, those events can help you with that journey before you even talk to a recruiter.
Thanks, Stu. Looking forward to having you out to one of them, man. Got to fly you out to one of these down in Destin or California, or maybe host one up there in New England.
Hey, man, I'm here in Maryland. I got plenty of people here too. So
let's do it.
No, I do like those things. I've done a few myself. I've done a few with some other spec ops guys before, and they're fun. They're exhausting. I will say that. As an instructor, I'm a much better coach than I am instructor. And, for me to be the bad guy is completely exhausting. At the end of that event, I'm just like, oh my God, I'm just tired of yelling at people.
You can let me be the bad guy, Stu.
Yeah, I'm the good guy. I'm a good guy. I'm a coach. I'll work on technique. I'll teach, procedures. I'm the good guy. So that's exciting, Jason. Any final comments? I appreciate your time on doing this. These two through and afters are really just a good insight for young men and women who are seeking to serve in these type of professions to take a look at the journey. And the journey isn't always perfect. The journey is filled with ups and downs and successes and failures / learning experiences that we all have gone through. So expect that and be able to move to the next level. Those are my final words that I've learned from your story. But you got any final notes for the folks listening?
Just want to say thanks for having me on, Stu. You're a humble, awesome person, and you've been making a difference for the special operations community for many years. You're innovative and creative, and it's an honor to be here on the podcast with you today.
Oh, well, thank you very much. That's way too nice.
for the listeners out there, in America today, one of the biggest issues that we have is what I call a sense of entitlement. It's where we feel that we deserve certain things. Well, we can't know if we deserve something or if something is a blessing unless we've had it taken away or we haven't had it in the first place. So this is a generation that has grown up with Stu Smith. This is a generation that feels that perhaps they are entitled to having this type of wisdom and this type of knowledge and resources. But Stu really made this happen himself. So make sure to give Stu an extra thanks. Make sure to check on him and see how he's doing from time to time. And go and replicate. Go and do this for somebody after you accomplish your goals. Continue to spread the torch. Continue to spread the fire. Because this country needs not just more special operators, but it needs more good men and women, more strong men and women of character that want to go serve this great country. So thanks again for what you're doing, Stu. It's an honor to be on your podcast, bro.
Oh, thank you. And I'm sure you would agree with me that, when you do these events and you meet these young people who want to serve at the highest levels, you guys give me hope for the future. You guys listening, that are thinking about these journeys, you really do give me hope for the future, especially in the last 20 years when you knew you were going to war. So thank you.
Well said, Stu. You guys are the hope of this country. You prove that this generation hasn't changed.
Yep. Amen. Amen. All right. So everybody check out Jason Sweet over at SOCOMAthlete.com and see if you got what it takes. Jason, thank you so much for taking time to do this with us.
My pleasure, Stu.